Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is my good buddy, and he is the foremost expert on the global monetary system, Jeff Snyder. Welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
Thanks, George. How are you doing?
Doing great. I'm doing awesome. We got a lot to talk about. I mean, this week we got the Fed coming out. Are they going to do 75? Are they going to do 100? We got the, I think the GDP numbers come out this week as well, and some more interesting stuff. So what are your thoughts on all the data points that we're going to be receiving?
Yeah, like you said, George, it's not like there's a shortage of interesting topics that we can cover. We've got macroeconomics, we've got monetary economics, and I'm sure we've got some political stuff, social stuff we can get into too. But overall, I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot of surprise here, at least nowadays. It might have been a surprise to people last year, but I think it's the idea of recession has finally pretty much accepted, certainly in most of the public's mind. I mean, there's going to be some holdouts in at the Fed, politics, government.
Not with the White House. Did you see him change the definition of recession today?
Well, I hate to say, hey, hold on a second. I actually agree with them.
Okay.
In one respect, because this technical definition of recession, that's not really a definition. I mean, it's sort of a rule of thumb.
But I would say their timing is a little suspicious here.
No question. But I think, in my mind, it's like, the two negative quarters in a row is sort of the warm-up act here. That's kind of the real scary thought. Well, they're saying, hey, that stuff behind us, we've had two negative quarters or likely had two negative quarters in a row. We find out on Thursday. To me, that's not the recession. That's not the thing that the markets are worried about. They're worried about that as the opening act to what follows the rest of this year. So you think about why are curves so upside down? We're starting this year in the negative two straight quarters, and the market is still worried about what's ahead of us, not what's behind us. So if the White House wants to litigate, the technical definition of recession, that's fine. And I would agree with them, but that's beside the point, which is probably their point, is to, another distraction. Let's not pay attention to the recession. Let's pay attention to something else. I guess inflation.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're saying that what the curves are telling us, and we'll get into that, or what they're warning us about isn't necessarily two consecutive quarters of negative real GDP growth. There's something going on that's far more risky out there. There's something that has a lot more downside, maybe is a better way to say it.
Yeah, it's more than just, are we going to have to debate about the technical definition? This is not about technicalities here. This is about some real world phenomena that is likely to have a serious downside risk to it. Not just downside risk in the economy as well as the markets.
Yeah. So what do you think? I know that no, we'll call it recession or black swan event is the same. I mean, you could say maybe 100 years ago, we had a COVID type event, so maybe in the next 100 years, we'll get something like that. But rarely do we see the same act play out two times in a row as far as a financial crisis. So what as far as probabilities, what do you think the financial crisis looks like that the curves are warning us about?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right, George. If you look at, say, for example, the Eurodollar futures curve, last week it hit a level of inversion we hadn't seen since September of 2007, which to me, I mean, that's something that should really ring some alarm bells, because September 2007 was after the global financial crisis had already begun, and it was mere weeks away from the Fed's first rate cut. So the Eurodollar futures market, in order to get us into that shape, is inverted about 125 basis points between the top and the near-term spread to, I think it was December 2008, maybe September 2008 from the September 2007 contract. So relatively speaking, to get that depth of inversion, we had to already be inside the financial crisis. It had already begun, and the Fed was already about to do its rate cutting.
Right.
And so that's what we see in the Eurodollar futures curve today. Now, I hesitate to make that comparison, not because I want to compare curves, but as you said, this isn't going to be another 2008. We're not going to see a replay of the first global financial crisis, because a lot of things are very different. For example, the banking system, individual banks. We're not going to see another Lehman Brothers. We're not going to see another Bear Stearns. There won't be a rash of nationalized banks across the world, because by and large, most banks have indeed fortified their own balance sheets to the point where they're going to be able to withstand whatever crisis, whatever problem we're about to hit, that whatever it is that the market is actually really worried about, and it's not, you know, the past 6 months. So what the market is saying is that there's something underlying, some deflationary monetary details that are significant enough and substantial enough that they're maybe equivalent to what we saw in the late part of 2007, 15 years ago. So something beyond your garden variety recession, something beyond your garden variety, oh, okay, there's a little bit of a illiquidity in certain markets, but not necessarily a replay of 2008. So something in the same category.
Yeah, you know, the way I picture it in my mind is like Hoover Dam. You ever been to Hoover Dam?
I haven't, no.
Oh, you haven't? Oh, you got to go. But I've been there several times because my mom lives in Vegas. And I just, you know, if Hoover Dam was needed maintenance, let's say, and it started to crack, you know, you get the water starting to shoot out of the cement, let's say, in a certain point, and it starts gushing out, and that's the GFC. And then we take some cement to kind of patch that one area. But now it's not like we're going to see water gushing out of that same area. There's going to be a different crack in the dam that's going to show up, where the curves are telling us water is going to start gushing out, but we just don't really know where exactly in the dam. But the problem is the same. The core problem, the root problem, is the same, and that is that the dam is broken, and we need a new dam. And where I'm going with that, Jeff, is the and correct me if I'm wrong, but the problem, the main issue with the GFC, is that the Eurodollar system broke down. And the main issue today is that the Eurodollar system is still broken, just like that dam is still structurally flawed, but we see the water gushing out of another area.
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest point here, is that, good analogy, George, the dam is still broken and we never really fixed it. We stopped the water sort of leaking, or at least we stopped the public's ability to see the water leaking. We kind of hid that for the last 15 years, but intermittently along the way, we've seen new cracks appear, smaller leaks appear. But if we go by what the markets are telling us now, this is probably the most dangerous point we've seen since 2007, the pre-crisis era. Now, what exactly does that mean going forward? It's tough to tell, because it's impossible to predict how these things go. But we do have some reasonable idea of what's going on underneath the surface, monetarily speaking. And it's, again, it's the same song and dance. It's the same old tale from 2007 and 2008. You know, everybody got the wrong idea about what happened the first time, thinking it was about subprime mortgages and reckless Wall Street lending. Those were just symptoms of the bigger problem, or the bigger issue, which still remains, which is an inherently flawed monetary system that just doesn't work. And at the first sign of trouble, it doesn't just, you know, take a little bit of risk off the table. Dealers instead just completely exit markets and leave them completely illiquid, which creates all sorts of contagion and knock-on feedback effects.
I think the pushback there, with someone who understands what you're saying, is, well, we can just take all of that, all those liquidity needs, and move it from the commercial bank's balance sheets onto the Fed's balance sheet. And then the Fed can just backstop everything, like repo, let's say. So what's wrong with that argument?
It's completely untrue. It's not even close. So what the Fed does is it tries to replicate some of the behaviors, for example, repo. And the ECB is actually much far more advanced along these lines than the Federal Reserve is. The Federal Reserve is downright primitive.
Which is their standing repo facility and reverse repo?
Yeah, well, the reverse repo is the opposite. The reverse repo is supposed to soak up excess reserves, which it has done. But that, even that, misidentifies the larger problem, which is lack of collateral, which the Fed does nothing about. And their repo operations that they implemented in September of 2019 are not actually repo operations, and they're not meant to be repo operations. They're meant to provide the public with some form of cover, because, hey, something was going on in repo markets in September of 2019. Nobody has a damn clue what it is. But look, the Fed named its operations repo, so we're all supposed to be happy that the Fed is fixing the repo market, when nobody has any idea what the Fed's doing or what was actually broken. And I include the Federal Reserve in that. To this day, they still don't know what happened in September of 2019, but they got a really good taste of it in March of 2020 when they realized they made the situation much, much worse than it needed to be by taking T-bills out of the marketplace.
Right.
Over 300 billion of them between September and October of 2019.
And then they reversed as soon as they figured out what they were doing, they reversed and said, whoa, stop with the T-bills. Let's move to the longer end of the curve.
They didn't, you know, that's the thing. They stopped in March. I think it was the week of March 19th of 2020, which was the height of the March 2020 crisis. They stopped buying treasury bills. They didn't give them back to the market. But ever since then, the balance of in the SOMA portfolio for treasury bills has been exactly the same week after week after week.
It's right around 300 billion.
326.044. Yeah. And it's them saying, yeah, we kind of screwed up here. We took bills out of the marketplace, which goes back to the bigger picture. In the grand scheme of things, what the Federal Reserve has to offer is not what the system needs. The closest thing that we have to elasticity in terms of collateral is the Treasury Department issuing Treasury bills. Yeah. But what is the Treasury Department doing right now? They're cutting back all of the good stuff, all the Treasury, but even the two-year notes that they just got auctioned off today. There's fewer two-year notes being auctioned off. So as far as collateral supply, which is from the Treasury Department, that's being cut back because Treasury doesn't care about any of this stuff. They're just trying to manage the deficit.
I didn't know that. They're at the auctions, they're issuing more of the longer dated treasuries.
Fewer. I mean, they've over the last year or so, they've tried to skew the auctions toward the longer end of the curve. But because deficits have fallen substantially since, the CARES Act and all the helicopter drops, there's less actually being auctioned off, less on the run securities, right, especially in treasury bills and short term notes, which has just left the system high and dry.
Oh, I didn't know that what they were issuing was more of the longer end of the curve. I thought they were still issuing, if they issued, let's say, $60 billion at an auction, I was assuming that, 50 of it would be T-bills.
Yeah, and it's not the T-bills have cut way back on the T-bills. Like I said, even the two-year notes have dropped down. They were about August, September, they were auctioning about $60 billion in two-year notes. They're down to, I think, $48 billion as of today. So that's a pretty substantial drop in two-year notes to go along with all these other treasury bills that are not hitting the market, which is leaving collateral supply extremely tenuous.
Right. Don't they see the delta between reverse repo and the 4-week? You'd think if they saw that delta, they'd be like, well, the market needs more 4-week T-bills.
They do. And they have seen it. It's the Treasury Department just converted a cash management bill into a regular benchmark offering. And all they said about it was that these bills are incredibly popular. They don't say why. They just say that these bills are incredibly popular. And so we're trying to satiate demand. And so the argument is, do they actually know what's going on here and they're just trying to hide it? Or are they really that clueless and stupid? And I hate to say, but I think it is the latter. They are that clueless. They don't really understand why treasury bills are in such demand. You look at the bill rates today. I mean, we're three days away from RRP being 2.3%, and the 4-week bill is around 2.10. The 8-week bill is around 2.20. So they're less than what the RRP is going to be in a couple of days from now, and material less than those, let alone another rate hike that's going to happen in September. So there's some tremendous demand for pristine treasury bills because there's such a collateral shortage.
What's your view on the standing repo facility? Is that something that could theoretically backstop if there was a break in the repo market, such as what we saw in September 2019?
It doesn't help because all it does is really soak up basically what some of the higher quality credits are able to go to the Fed and issue and to deliver collateral that they can then get access from the Fed. But don't forget, the standing repo facilities were live, and through much of the March 2020 crisis, they were theoretically unlimited. The Fed was going to issue however much.
Up to a trillion a day, I think they were saying, right?
And guess what? What happened during especially the first half of March of 2020?
Yeah,
use of the standing repo facility declined as the crisis got worse, because nobody had any collateral to post. These things are collateralized. And as we go through these crises time and time and time again, the problem isn't bank reserves, because bank reserves are useless. The problem is collateral. We saw this in Europe a decade ago. the 2011 crisis, 2011-2012 crisis was a collateral crisis. And how the ECB at least attempted to deal with it was basically saying, you give us any junk that you have and we'll take it. We don't even care. They expanded the list of eligible collateral because nobody had enough collateral to borrow from these central banks at their stated eligibility requirements.
Right, right. I mean, at what point do they just not require collateral?
It just simply auction funds?
Yeah, or just uncollateralized loans.
I don't think they can do that at all. I mean, well, yeah, I mean, 13.3 gives them, they give broad emergency powers, but they
resist. Okay, so the Federal Reserve Act says they can't do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they could, theoretically, but they would have to go to Congress and say, we're basically risking the Federal Reserve balance sheet for whatever reason. There's a reason why the discount window, which is called primary credit, there's a reason why the discount window has always been collateralized. This goes back to Walter Badgett in the 19th century.
Right.
We're not going to lend cash to banks that have done stupid things, which, I mean, let's face it, that's not true, but that's the operating paradigm. That's the ethos of the Fed and any central bank is you have to prove to me that you're a responsible institution. And the way you prove to me you're a responsible institution is you post good quality collateral. And if you don't have good quality collateral, you probably deserve to go out of business. And that's kind of true, right? I mean, we want banks, as any businesses who do a really bad job of lending, to go out of business because that increases the efficiency of the overall intermediation function of the monetary system. And that hasn't changed even nowadays. I know too big to fail was a big issue in 2008, 2009, where it seemed like the Fed was just bailing out everybody because they didn't know what else to do. And to some degree, that was true. But by and large, that's still the operating doctrine, is that we only rescue the financial firms that can demonstrate that they're solvent, they're good, they're in good standing. And the way you do that is with collateral.
Right, right. Okay, I want to switch it up a little bit and go to a conversation that you had with Emil, and I think it was with Steve the other day as well, where you guys are talking about dollar shortages with Japanese banks. And when I was listening to that podcast, and I listened to almost every episode of Eurodollar University. But when I was listening to it, I'm like, okay, if I'm a bank in the Eurodollar system, theoretically, I can create as many new dollars as I want. That's what they do, is they create dollar-denominated loans. And I think, okay, well, if I'm two banks that have a relationship, and I forgot what's it called a NOS account, a VOS account, something like that. But if you and I own banks, separate banks, and then I can say, okay, Jeff, I'll just set up an account. You have a checking account with me, and we'll put $1 million in it. You do the same thing. Now, all of a sudden, we've got $1 million asset, $1 million liability. We're good to go. So we just created $1 million for ourselves to go ahead and do whatever we need to do with it. So I'm thinking, okay, from that standpoint, there's really not a dollar. You can't have scarce dollars or a lack of dollars, because they can create these dollars at will. It's just maybe there's an issue with counterparty risk, so they're not willing to create the amount of dollars that are needed, therefore a dollar shortage. So let's go back to these Japanese banks. Why are they short of dollars if they can create those dollars? Is it that they're not plugged in to the euro dollar system, to where they don't have those relationships required to be able to do that transaction like I described, where where you and I own banks and I just set up an account for you and post $1 million in there and you do the same for me? Or you see where I'm going with that?
Yep. And I think that's the pre-crisis way of doing business, is that there was a lot of unsecured business where, the analogy that you just produced is that, hey, George, I know you, we've been doing business forever. I'll just create a liability. I get an asset, you get a liability, and everybody's happy.
Everyone's got the dollars they need.
Yeah, that sort of died out over the last 15 years because there are internal constraints to creating dollars. It is not, theoretically, dollar creation is unlimited. Even in the pre-crisis era, that wasn't entirely true. There are constraints on balance sheet.
What are the constraints? Dollar creation.
They're internal constraints. There's risk budgets. There's risk controls. There's all sorts of committees. In the pre-crisis era, these were not so onerous that they got in the way of banks experimenting and doing risky things, because back then, recency bias and confirmation bias, everybody thought, well, you know, I'll look at what you're doing. You're creating $1 million asset, which is a liability for you. There's a little bit of risk there, but we don't see any risk because there hasn't been anything that's gone wrong in forever. Right, so right. We're not going to stand in the way. You do whatever the hell you want. Since 2007, that's no longer the case. In fact, most banks operate very differently, where there's now layers of compliance. There's layers of accountants. There's layers of you know, regulatory checks. Mm. There's all sorts of things that prevent banks from just saying, I'm going to do this because I think I can, or I think I want to. Now you have to live within, say, a risk-weighted asset budget. You have to live within a very much tightened internal control environment, something like Vega or VAR, something simple like VAR, where I look at you and I say, George, I know we've been doing business for a long period of time and I want to give you this $1 million.
Right.
But we've done all our black box calculations and the risk adjusted return doesn't make it worth it for me to do this, because then I'd have to justify to the compliance manager why I'm doing something that the models are telling me I'm not getting paid enough for.
Right.
So in order for you and I to do this, you got to offer me much bigger spread in order for me to give you this $1 million.
Yeah, because the perceived risk side of the equation increased exponentially since 2007, because they didn't think that type of risk existed. Now they understand that type of risk exists and they need to be compensated for it. And so it's not really a matter of a dollar shortage. It's a matter of confidence in counterparty risk shortage.
Which is the same thing. You're basically right. Saying the same thing in different ways. And it's really a balance sheet shortage is what we're really talking about. It's not that there's a lack of physical dollars, because nobody uses physical dollars. It's a lack of the willingness and the ability of the banking system to create additional dollars in response to market changes. These are dynamic conditions, remember? So what we may have been doing yesterday was perfectly fine, given the black box model calculations that my firm has done, but then something changed. Today, we look at some of the markets and some of the signals, correlations are going up, whatever it might be. Suddenly, the black box model says that loan you were doing with George yesterday, if you want to do it today, you got to charge them an additional premium, or you've got to add some collateralized component. You've got to add something that makes it either lower the risk or raise the return. And if you're in a collateral constrained environment, or your own balance sheet constrained environment, you're not going to be able to do that so easily.
Yeah,
so
that's the mismatch between needs and collateral.
Right.
Liquidity and so needs and collateral, yeah.
If you're the Japanese bank and I'm knocking on your door saying, you know, we did this loan yesterday for $1 million. Today, in order for me to do this $1 million loan, you've got to pay a ridiculously high interest rate, or you got to make it secure for me, which means I'm basically telling you to post collateral or we can't do business anymore. And if you don't have the collateral, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to go find somebody else, but in a collateral constrained systemic environment, nobody else has collateral to lend you. So you're kind of stuck, which means you're left with only bad options, including paying through the roof for collateral rental rates, or in the most extreme cases, you start fire selling assets, which only contributes to the self-reinforcing vicious cycle, because as you're fire selling assets, asset prices fall, liquidity in those markets fall, more asset sales, and
the counterparty risk increases.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which so only you need more collateral. So then there's more demand for collateral.
We need more collateral, and just round and round and round it goes.
Yeah. So the next question I want to ask is, what do you think the probabilities are that the United States is in a recession or going into a recession? Probably a softball there. And then on top of that, what do you think the Fed's response is going to be? And more importantly, the government's response, because I try to think through this from a standpoint of inflation, disinflation, deflation. So if we're going to assume that, let's say there's a 90% probability that we're headed for recession, and that's what the curves are telling us, that the Fed's going to drop rates back down to zero. And why would they do that? Because there's some serious economic problems that we're going through. But then you got to say, okay, well, then what's the government's response? And then is it going to be a CARES Act 2.0? And then do we get a decade that looks a lot more like the 40s instead of the 70s? And I know you know what I'm referring to there.
Yeah. And I think that's really where we're going here. Okay, first part first, I think that there's nothing is ever 100% certain, but in terms of economic probabilities, a recession is about as close as it's going to get. And I would wager a significant amount that recession began around March, maybe April, perhaps May. Over the last few months, we see a lot of economic data just fall off a cliff. And you've seen some really sharp changes, in, for example, in labor market data, which is usually a lagging to coincident indicator.
Right.
You know, a household survey dropped in April, came back a little bit in May, and then dropped again in June, which is highly unusual to see those levels of declines for a three-month period. In fact, you have to go all the way back to 2010. So something very serious changed. Jobless claims have been rising. Yes, they're at a low level. They're at an extremely low level, but they've been rising steadily ever since the end of March. So there is a very decent chance that the U.S. entered a recession. As we said, we're already going to see probably two negative quarters in a row of GDP sort of as the appetizer to the actual recession entree that's upcoming. So the fact that, I mean, if we aren't in a recession now, then the second half of the year is about as close to
And Jeff, also talk about, and we're going to get into the monetary and fiscal policy in a moment. Well, it's, remind me to circle back, but talk a little bit about the inversions increasing. And what I mean by that is we started with the, what, probably the fives and tens or something. And this, then that moves to the two year, and that used to the 1 year. Now I just checked it. I had some buddies in town, so I haven't been able to really check the data since.
You
mean, like,
that's not what you guys, what you do Friday? With your friends, sit around and watch the yield curve all day.
We were, you know,
it's just me.
Yeah. No, we were having a good time. You know, we were renting ATVs and, you know, going out and drinking and going to barbecues and whatnot. But anyway, on Sunday, I looked at the, and I know last week or about a week and a half ago, we went to the 6 month inverted with the 10 year. So it's going further to the left. And then I looked, but it was only maybe a couple basis points. And then Sunday I looked at it and the 10 year was like at 2.75 or 2.78. And then the 6 month was like 20 basis points higher. Yeah. I'm like, whoa, this is really getting dramatic. So maybe walk through people through why that's important, what we've seen with the Treasury curve over the past couple of months, and then we'll go into the fiscal and monetary response.
Yeah, with curves, it always starts out in the outer years because the outer years are where the markets are more independent minded. They're doing growth and inflation expectations. Irving Fisher, you know, going back to the decomposition of yields. So there's less influence of short-term things, including the Federal Reserve's ability to affect the short-term end of the curve. So what you usually see is that when something starts to bother the market, when enough people in those markets are starting to hedge against an uncertainty in the future, you'll see a little bit of a tiny blip down the curve. Mm. That started in the Eurodollar futures curve all the way back on December 1st.
Right.
And it was in this way distant December. I think it was the 2025 contracts way down the road. And it was only a single basis point.
Yeah, I remember you talking about it.
Even that was enough to say, this is a oh shit moment because the market, for any kind of curve that should be upward sloping, for it to flatten out to the point that it even inverts even a single basis point, because you got to remember in these markets, you have huge money players who have every incentive, if they see something like that happen, an inversion in the curve, to take the other side of the trade, to say, oh, this is crazy. There's nothing going wrong here. And if nothing goes wrong, I'm going to make a ton of money because this curve is out of shape. So what happens is you have that little bit of inversion, which is enough of the market beginning to hedge and not enough of the market taking the other side of the hedge so that it starts to show up. And if that uncertainty, if that risk that the market is perceiving grows and it starts to be accepted by more and more parts of the market, then you see the inversion start to spread. It gets further in terms of depth. It becomes bigger, not just a basis point, might become a couple or five or six, and it will move further and further up the curve as more and more of the market starts to come around to this risk view. Mm-hmm. So what happens is you have this tug of war between different viewpoints where if nothing was going to happen, if the market believed everything was fine, everybody would arb that inversion away. It would just disappear. But if more and more people come around to the hedging side, then the inversion grows. Mm-hmm. So as we see the inversion grow and spread further and further closer to the front of the curve, that is the market becoming more and more certain that what everybody's hedging against is actually going to happen. Because remember, this is all about probabilities. So the more inverted, the closer it gets to the front of the curve, the more certain the market is becoming, and then you start making judgments about what it is that they're hedging against, how soon, how deep, how bad, and all sorts of other different probabilities. But by and large, when you see inversion spread, whether it's Eurodollar futures or the treasury curve, same thing, closer it gets to the front, the deeper it gets, the more you know the market is okay. There's almost nobody left that's going to take the other side of the hedge trade. So these curves become very distorted. We saw it in the treasury curve. It first inverted to the 7 to 10 year spread back in March. And then, as is normally the case in inversion, the inversion disappeared, then it came back and it disappeared and went in and out over time, which is just the market sort of debating all the dynamic probabilities. And then really since April, it's kind of been, okay, completely inverted. And then that inversion is moving closer and closer to the front. As you said, George, right now, the 6 month is inverted to the 10 year as well as the 30 year. So it is incredibly upside down because the market is saying all of it uniformly that the Fed has only got a couple more rate hikes in it before whatever happens, happens, and they stop hiking rates. They reach the terminal thing, the terminal level, and likely they start going the other direction.
Right. Okay. So that takes us to the monetary and fiscal. Let's just assume the Fed drops rates down to zero, that would be an environment where they would, even the White House would have to acknowledge that we're in a recession, right?
I don't know. They could get really creative here. They could, I'm sure, you know, don't put them past them to say that, hey, this is not a recession. This is some new term that they could come up with.
Yeah. And I think you and Emil were talking about how the Fed came out with an article the other day saying, just completely ignore the twos and the tens. It's all about the Fed funds and,
the short term spread,
something like that.
Yeah. There's this whole academic argument that yield curve inversion doesn't matter until it reaches the front. And Emil and I were just flabbergasted because we say it always starts and then it reaches the front. So why would you ignore it when it starts in the back and only pay attention to it when it finally gets to the front? Well, their argument is that the Fed won't make a mistake and they could possibly rescue the economy before it gets that far. And what Emil and I were laughing about was the fact it never happens. Once the inversion starts, it's going to get to the front at some
point. I think it's all about the White House thing. Just them trying to say, oh, nothing to see here. Nothing, move along. Nothing to see here.
But at some point, you know, doesn't it make it worse? Because let's say you're Jay Powell and you're thinking, all right, first of all, I didn't want to hike rates to begin with because this transitory stuff, I didn't really go along with it. But, you know, okay, I got to hike rates to make it look like we're doing something about consumer prices. And so we did that. But now it's become very clear. Even some of the Fed models are saying the more likely recession than not. You would think that Jay Powell would say, okay, no matter what the Fed's or what the White House is telling me, I got to at least say something that looks like it's going to be realistic because something is going to happen over the next 6 months and you can't spend all your credibility in denial because once you do that, there's no going back.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And just FYI, I don't know if you saw the New York Times article. I think it was yesterday, the day prior, but Krugman came out and admitted that he was wrong about inflation. So that's probably the biggest contrarian indicator out there, meaning that when the CARES Act was going through and all this, he thought, oh, don't worry about inflation. Don't worry about inflation. Don't worry about inflation. And then he's coming out now and saying that he was wrong. And so, again, that's probably peak inflation right there. Right.
You know, that's anyway. The thing that it's so silly but it's really tragic because you think about really the underlying economic fundamentals here is that we went into the 2020 pandemic overreaction and not a very good place to start with. I mean, the economy had never recovered from 2008. And then we imposed upon it massive costs, including expansion of the federal government's deficit, which, as Japan has taught us, is only going to be deflationary and depressing down the road. So we go into 2020 and then things start moving back. You know, we get reopening and there's all this other stuff. Then early 2021, consumer prices start to accelerate, and everybody starts to think that we were actually going to make it through 2020 without suffering any permanent damage from it. And that was always, you know, a very low probability. And I think that's part of what's spooking the markets is that now that this, you know, supply shock dynamic is coming off the boil and the economies are starting to revert to their mean, what is the mean that we're reverting to? What if the mean that we're reverting to is something substantially worse than the pre-2020 baseline? What if once we get past all this artificial government interference, the economy really is incredibly damaged? I mean, we know it is.
Yeah,
how many small businesses were just completely destroyed? by the pandemic overreaction, by the politics of it.
There's a misallocation of resources and malinvestment. I mean, just go down the line.
On top of that, it's been a windfall to the most, the least productive economic sectors like oil. It's been great to be Saudi Arabia or Russia, but that doesn't help the global economic sustainability over the next 10 years or so.
Yeah.
So we've done everything wrong for the last 2 years, and then beginning that doing everything wrong from a very difficult place to begin with. And so I understand why markets are hedged the way they're hedged. Once we revert to the mean, that mean might be very ugly.
Yeah, but it's almost like they're saying or predicting that we're going to, that the economy, the underlying economy, or what we will go to, is the underlying economy that we would have had without the central planning intervention of 2020. So just imagine what the economy would have done. Just go back to when the lockdowns, you know, when they lock everyone in a cage, they shut down all the global supply chains, they shut down the entire global economy. And how deflationary would that have been? Just minus the stimmies, minus the PPP, minus the Fed backstopping. And maybe that's what the markets are now predicting that we're going to move into as far as an economic environment.
Yeah, and I think that's, and then the counter argument that they'll make is that they wanted to prevent that kind of thing happening. So if it is actually happening and all they did was kick the can down the road, then it would have been better to get it done and over with in 2020 to let the market clear out all the stuff. Although that would have been incredibly difficult with the government interfering in all sorts of ways. But
yeah, still, but I would have argued that they shouldn't have locked everyone in a cage to begin with.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I mean, that once that tactic was unleashed, there was no going back. I mean, that was essentially the kill shot to the economy for much of it anyway, at the margins. Yeah. So once they did that, I mean, it was sort of like, let's get it done and over with, you know, rip the Band-Aid off and hopefully hope for the best here. Because I think that's exactly what the markets and the curves are. And it's, again, this is not just the U.S. This is the entire global economy we're talking about here, where the markets are looking at it and saying, you know, if we had a 1 year temporary reprieve or 18 month temporary reprieve because of all the government action, and all it did was buy us 18 months for nothing, then we're just going to experience where we would have been anyway. I think that, you know, the long run economic damage by doing that is even worse than had they done nothing.
Oh, I agree. Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out of control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow rebel capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level. So then that takes us into the policy response. So let's assume that we're going into this, you know, massive economic depression, not just a mild, you know, couple quarters here, but we go into a heavy duty recession that even the White House has to admit. What's the policy response? I mean, is it CARES Act 2.0? Is it $10 trillion in stimmy checks or PPP? And is the Fed doing, you know, $200 billion in QE and dropping rates down to zero or maybe even negative? And along with the supply chains being broken and most likely being damaged even further, you restrict supply. Does that give us another massive supply shock on top of heavy duty demand? And we go into like 1947. And you know what I'm talking about, where inflation then, because of that supply shock or whatever the reason, spikes up to 19.5. And then 2 years later, it's at -3 again.
Yeah, that's the 1940s after World War II. Even during World War II, there's a supply shock spike in consumer prices in 1943 when the U.S. entered the war, rationing of
water. Yeah, there was really three of them. For the viewers who don't know the chart, there's three of them there. There's one at the beginning, one, a huge one in 47, and then you get 3% deflation, and then a couple of years later, you go right back into another spike that got up to, I don't know, 12, 13.
Yeah, they make the current CPI look like nothing. I mean, that's sad. I mean, I don't know, 9% isn't nothing, but compared to 19.25 or whatever it was, yeah, that's nothing. And the reason is because, you know, it was more about the economic situation at the time rather than anything. You know, it wasn't over aggressive Federal Reserve policies or actual bank credit expansion. It was simply the kind of what we see now. So yeah. I can understand, George, why you're thinking, hey, this could end up being more like the 1940s.
And simply put, we go into 2023 and they increase demand again and decrease supply.
And I think that's the risk. Where I would not disagree, but I think the other part of the probability there is that because of what happened last year and this year, the political context has changed. Where the Republican Party, who are likely going to get majority of Congress, are going to say no. Democrats, absolutely. They're going to say, yes, we need CARES Act too. We need, hell with that. We need universal basic income. They're going to try to push this further along down that road. And I think the Republicans are going to say, no, are you crazy? Did you not see what happened in 2021 with consumer prices? And I think Republicans can galvanize enough public support for their position where it might mute some of the impact of the federal government's response. So we might not get the same 2020 level of intervention simply because everybody now thinks they did too much. And of course they did. Everybody now thinks they did too much. And that's kind of accepted by a lot of people. Nobody wants to see gasoline prices go to $10 a gallon because it was ultimately destructive at $5 a gallon. Mm-hmm. So it might be that part of the government says, we want to do massive amounts of stimulus. And the other parts of the government say, we're never going to vote for it because you guys screwed that up last time.
Okay, then what about the Fed? And I know that they don't matter don't because care. They're not a central bank, but I'm talking about they do matter for the stock market from a psychological standpoint. So let's say the Fed comes in and says, okay, we're going to take we took our balance sheet down to whatever, 8 by the time this happens. So now we're going to take our balance sheet up to, you know, 15 trillion or whatever it is. Does the stock market rebound just because that Pavlovian effect?
It might. It's possible. I mean, I remember back in 2010, summer of 2010, we just went through a repo crisis. Was not about Greek debt. It was about repo collateral shortage. You know, we had the flash crash in May of 2010. It was only a year after the global financial crisis had ended and the economy was not recovering. Everything looked really bad. And I thought, yeah, we're going to get another downward leg in stocks. But what happened? The Fed did, you know, late August of 2010, Ben Bernanke shows up at Jackson Hole and hints at QE2, and the stocks just take off.
Right.
They go
right
through the moon because of that sentimental psychological effect. And so you can't discount that. But the flip side case to that is Japan. Japanese stocks did very poorly during the QE periods because they're more fundamental. Maybe they're not susceptible. There's more of an institutional bias in Japanese stocks, whatever the case may be. But George, I would expect if things do get bad over the next 6 months and into next year, that the Fed isn't going to just do regular QE because they can't. Remember, this is psychological. They cannot continue to do the same things over and over.
You got
to
do more of it or new. Yeah.
More of it or something new. So I would expect that the Fed is going to say, well, we'll buy X number of treasuries, we'll buy X number of MBS, but now we're going to start buying ETFs.
Right.
We got to do something. We got to do DOJ something playbook. Brand new and shocking. And so I would expect the Fed is going to come up with whatever. And it could have a short run impact on the stock market and other risky asset classes because, you know, certainly on this side of the Pacific, there's a lot of appetite for what the Fed sells. So possibly. But you have to wonder, can the Fed do it before the stock market enters a further decline, or will it come afterward? And again, you have to wonder if the Fed is going to be late to respond because of how it's being perceived as creating this inflationary environment to begin with. So maybe they're going to be a little bit gun shy about going to more extreme measures and try to do this willy-nilly fine-tuning. Oh, we'll cut rates a little bit. So that's monetary policy environment that looks more like, you know, late 2007 and early 2008, rather than going full on to 11 from the get-go.
Right, right. So from what I'm hearing, we go into a recession and then the government's response is less than it was potentially, or the probability, the government's response is less than it was CARES Act. So although that might keep us from going into a deflationary environment, outright deflation, you know, maybe that keeps up the CPI at 2% or 3%. Because again, my concern there is the supply chains. As we can talk about the demand side, but if supply is decreasing as a result of what they're doing in the government intervention, that's still going to add a tailwind, let's say, to consumer prices. So that's why I hesitate to go absolute deflation, although obviously it's possible if you look at the 1940s for sure. But they're not able to do enough of a CARES Act to take us up to that next 10%, 12%, if we're looking at the 1940s and 1947, right? That middle spike that really goes up high. But then the Fed, so let's say CPI is now at 3% or 4%, then the Fed comes in and says, okay, well, we'll do whatever we need to do because we see the CPI trending down, and they come in and start buying equities, because of they'll just say wealth effect, something like that.
Yeah, I think that the issue then is timing, and I think that's the downside problem. That's really part of the issue with the 1940s, is that everything was thrown out of whack, where you had normally you had smooth business cycles where everything was sort of timed together or put together. Where, I mean, obviously World War II and the destruction that had across the world threw everything out of whack. So demand came back much sooner than supply could. And that was the difference that led to rising consumer prices.
And the price controls, right? They took off the price controls
in the 1940s. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So once that happened, it was, consumer prices just took off. And the other thing is that they didn't just take off and come right back down. As you said, it was a 2-year period where consumer prices were up for quite a long period of time, even by I think it was early half of 1948 that we still had double digit CPI. So it was relatively unstable period. And I think that's kind of what we're kind of beating around the bush here, George, is what we're saying is what we're looking at is potentially a period of even greater instability, not just in terms of economy, but also consumer prices, which just makes everything worse.
Right.
When I sit back and look at the way the curves are shaped today, compared to where they had been in similar time periods over the last 15 years, similar circumstances, what the curves are saying is that the 2020s look to be either more uncertain or potentially worse than the 2010s had been, which is, you think that, how can that possibly be? The 2010s were the worst economic decade since the 1930s. So how can we get worse than the last decade? And the answer is the 1940s. If we're gonna add another element of price instability on top of lack of economic growth, that would certainly fit the bill, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's layer on top the tick data that you guys went over in a previous episode, I think on Friday or Thursday, something like that. Because I want to get into the long end of the curve, because I think a hang up for a lot of people is, okay, I see what these curves are telling us, but how can we depend on them to a great degree, because they're so influenced by the Federal Reserve or the central banks, let's say it just intervening in the market, right? But you guys brought up an interesting fact that although these central banks are selling a lot of treasuries, and you can blame that on Russia or de-dollarizing or whatever, but the private sector is actually picking up the slack to a great degree. And what else is interesting, Andreas Steno Larsson? He's on Twitter, and he's doing a lot of stuff with Real Vision right now. He's a great guy. And he's also doing a podcast with Macro Elf, with Alfonso.
So I know Andreas.
You know, yeah. Alfonso well.
Yeah, I did a Real Vision appearance with Andreas, yes.
Okay. So I had an interview with him last week, and he's in Denmark, I believe. And I said, for you, let's walk through your mentality of buying treasuries, because the euro is going down against the dollar. So you, and I said flat out, do you care about the inflation rate in the US? It's like, no, because my expenses are denominated in euros, not dollars. So as long as the dollar is appreciating against the euro, then that's a double whammy for me. I can put my dry powder in treasuries, and it makes all the sense in the world. So when you guys were going over that tick data, I was thinking about that conversation I had with Andreas, and it made a lot of sense that the private sector is buying up the long end of the U.S. Treasury curve.
Yeah, just to be clear, what we're talking about was that the latest tick data, which was for the month of May 2022, the private side of these overseas investors, so private overseas investors, mostly institutions, they bought the most U.S. Treasury notes and bonds on record. Something like $130 billion, I forget the exact number going off memory, but it was the most single month net purchasing of U.S. Treasury notes and bonds on record. And they have to be thanking Jay Powell for making them so cheap for them. Right. They're thinking, hey, this is great. He just put the, you know, because of the front end of the curve, they just put the price of these things into the toilet. If you're willing to pick up safe and liquid instruments that you're going to use as a rainy day fund, as Steve Van Meter points out, what better time to do it than May, than of course, probably June of 2022, because treasuries got really cheap, relatively speaking. But you know, the thing is, I think that's part of the problem here is a couple of things. Is that number one, the Fed does not influence interest rates as much as people think they do. Everybody goes back, the Fed is buying bonds, therefore that's why rates are low. Even the Fed will tell you they don't influence interest rates all that much. Academic studies, one after another proves the market controls interest rates at the long end, not the Federal Reserve. The latest metadata study showed that a $600 billion QE program that focused entirely on U.S. treasuries, you could expect the long-term treasury yield, the 10-year treasury yield, to decline by 15 basis points. That's it. $600 billion was the size of two QE2s. And if you're only going to get 15 basis points out of that, your only conclusion is the Fed does not really influence long-term interest rates is something that we're seeing today. Because let's face it, the Fed stopped buying treasury notes and bonds. And yes, there was a sell-off, but there was enough buying on the curve that it produced inversion, which tells you that the only reason the market sold off was because of the Fed's influence over short-term rates at the front. So there are buyers and bidders at the front, at the back end of the curve, whether or not the Fed's there or not. In fact, but hedge funds.
Is there an argument, though, that there's so much on the Fed's balance sheet that that's distorting the market because that supply would be in the private sector, therefore there would be more supply to meet that demand?
You're making an assumption that it wouldn't have been, that demand would not have been met without the Fed. And that's the fatal assumption that everybody wants to make because they want to believe in the Fed's ability when even the Fed doesn't even believe in the Fed's ability. But what they're saying is that there's so many treasuries out there without the Fed, then interest rates would have had to gone much higher, prices would have gone much lower. They made the same argument a couple years ago about foreigners. They said without foreigners, the treasury market was toast. And what happened? Foreigners were selling their treasuries and treasury prices were going up because we don't need foreigners. There are different pockets of investors that will take demand for U.S. treasury paper, whether the Fed's there or whether foreigners are there or not. Hedge funds is a perfect example because over the last 4 years or so, hedge funds have been arbitraging a basis trade, which is the difference between the futures market price and the cash market, to the tune of trillions. And everybody thinks that this is a problem. This contributed to March 20. Why? We can't depend upon hedge funds to buy treasuries when that's the wrong question to be asking. Why are hedge funds only interested in picking up nickels on a basis trade for safe and liquid instruments? Why aren't they doing something else more risky? So there is demand for safe and liquid paper beyond what the Federal Reserve or foreigners are going to be doing, whether or not they're buying or not. So the idea that without the Fed, the treasury market is toast is a counterfactual that has been basically conjured in order to continue to believe in the Fed's ability to influence stuff. When market curves, especially the shape of market curves, tells you that was never the case. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. All these academic studies come to the same conclusion. QE does not influence the level of interest rates.
On that note, or on a similar note, because I know you'll know this data right off the top of your head. I want to go back to the 1940s because people nowadays talk about yield curve control extensively, and they reference the 1940s.
Right.
But you know, I haven't done the research that you have. But the other day, I had this chart of the Fed's balance sheet during the 1940s. And then I saw what interest rates did at the long. They had the peg at 2.5, if I'm not mistaken, at the long
end. Long-term yields, yes.
Yeah, during the 1940s. But between, like, even during that period, 1947, if my memory serves me right, when the CPI got up to 19.5%, you would assume that the Fed's balance sheet would have exploded to maintain that peg at 2.5. But you actually see that the Fed's balance sheet from like 46 to like 50 or 51 was flat. They didn't have to buy, which would tell me, maybe I'm not reading the data correctly, but that would tell me that they didn't have to buy anything in order to keep the interest rates at 2.5%. So I know they had an explicit peg, but I don't know that they even needed to have it if I'm interpreting their balance sheet correctly. Am I making sense there?
You are, but there's a couple of different things that went on in the middle 1940s. One was stuff going on at the front end of the curve, certificates of indebtedness, as well as treasury bills. The Fed didn't want to be involved in those as much as they were. So what happened was sort of an operation twist in 1947, where the Fed did buy an extensive amount of notes and bonds,
okay,
but also let some of the short-term stuff that they had built up over the, you know, financing World War II.
So there was sort of
a twist there. But the argument there is whether or not they actually needed to do that to begin with. Did they actually need to buy notes and bonds? And what you see is that, as you said, George, interest rates were not rising. They didn't spike in 1946 when the CPI went through the roof.
In fact, I saw many times when the yield was underneath the peg.
It was
slightly, you know,
entire time. In fact, that was the only time in the peg's history, was in 1947, 1948, that the Fed ended up buying any bonds. And if you read some of the private transcripts, if you read some of the contemporary scholarship at the time, there was a great deal of argument whether or not they actually needed to do so. In some ways, the Fed, like it has done repeatedly throughout its history, sort of panicked. When the long-term treasury yield got up closer to 2.5%, the Fed just started buying bonds, not because they needed to, but because they're a bureaucracy.
Right. Their balance sheet didn't explode because they were selling their T-bills.
Right. And so they were saying, we need to buy X number of bonds regardless of what the market is. They weren't saying, I'm going to, like the Bank of Japan today, they weren't saying, I'm going to buy every bond that prices above a yield above 2.5%. They just started buying bonds in the market. And if you look at other interest rates like corporate bonds and municipal bond rates, they didn't rise all that much in that period either. And the Fed wasn't buying those at any point. So the Fed sort of panicked itself into buying bonds simply because sort of a prophylactic measure that maybe didn't need to be done. And then the part that most people forget or don't notice is that in 1948, the second half of 1948, it's 1949, the Fed sold about a third of those bonds they bought back into the market as yields tanked, went way below the 2.5% peg. And then, of course, the Fed made all sorts of arguments about why they needed to get rid of the bonds, whether or not those were going to be inflationary. The Fed thought they were. The Fed thought they were being inflationary at the time when deflation was actually happening. So the Fed's ability to screw up economy and inflation goes all the way back to the beginning. It's one of the constants of its actual operation. And I think that, you know, something I try to remind people is that this idea of don't fight the Fed, that is a very recent modern invention. That was something that came about in the 90s and 2000s. Mm. You go back to the 1980s and before, the Fed was a joke. And why wouldn't it have been? Its entire history was one massive failure after another. You had the Great Depression, which showed up not even 15 years after the Fed started, which was supposed to be the whole reason it existed in the first place. You had the worst depression in history, and the Fed does everything wrong that it could possibly do. And then you have the 1937 depression with an oppression that made another mistake. They had the 1950s inflation scare that never turned out to be inflation. Then you had the great inflation when the Fed was more worried about deflation when consumer prices were exploding in a sustained fashion everywhere. The Fed had no idea what was going on. Massive monetary banking evolution. They had no clue. It's just one mistake after another. And then suddenly we're supposed to believe the Fed put all its mistakes behind it and suddenly got everything right in the late 80s and early 90s.
Yeah, with like Volcker and Greenspan.
Yeah, that was all a myth. And if again, one of the things Emil and I have been doing recently, going back over the Volcker myth and the Greenspan myth, and they had no idea what they were doing. And in fact, a couple of the economists who coined the term great moderation in 2003, a couple of Princeton economists, James Stock and Mark Watson, said, this great moderation thing, the only thing that's really interesting about it is that we haven't had a monetary panic like we used to have. And we're not really sure why that is. We think it's just random good luck. And the Fed, of course, took credit for it. Ben Bernanke in particular said, no, that's us. We did that. And it wasn't. It was the Eurodollar system. The Eurodollar system was creating the money that that kept banking panics on the sidelines that allowed the great moderation to happen. And what happens? As soon as the Eurodollar system breaks down, we get a banking panic and deflation, and something we haven't been able to get out of. So the Federal Reserve, outside of this 20-year period or so, 25-year period, where it seemed like it was doing really well, it was just taking credit for something else. Yeah. And throughout its entire history, going back to the beginning, one massive failure after another, which Jay Powell's 2022 fiasco was only contributing to that the way it actually is at the Fed.
It's like a monetary rain dance. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah.
where they dance around and it rains. So they assume that just the dancing equals the rain.
And that's the mysticism. It's always doing, it's never proving causation. It's just looking at correlation and assuming causation, which, as Milton Friedman said in one of the last interviews he gave, the reason why monetary scholarship and monetary literacy is so difficult is because central banks employ almost all of the economists who work outside of academia, and therefore they always craft their opinions, their analysis, in a way that is most charitable to the central bank. Mm. So no matter what the central bank does, if there's a correlation that, you know, it correlates, if there's a monetary policy that correlates to some good economic or financial outcome, there'll be a whole bunch of economists who say, yes, there's a correlation, and you can bet the Fed is the reason for it, when in fact the Fed isn't. It's all just mysticism.
Yeah. Another thing, and I know we're running short on time here, and I want to be cognizant of that, but one thing that you've talked about a lot and has really helped my thinking is this idea from Friedman, I think, that cheap money doesn't necessarily mean easy money. And in fact, it can be the complete opposite, where if you've got cheap money, then it's actually tight money. And I've actually done a couple whiteboard videos on that, trying to kind of think through that in my own mind and kind of distill my ideas. But that's kind of the conclusion that I came to, is that just because we have cheap money doesn't mean we have easy money. And people often use those terms synonymously. And it could be that we have less tight money. I did admit that on the whiteboard video. It could be that if the Fed drops rates down to zero, it doesn't mean we have loose money, but maybe we have less tight money than we would if interest rates were, let's say, 5%, and they didn't even drop them at all due to a recession or, you know, any of the problems that we've seen in the Eurodollar market. And the main example I use is in 2012. And Jeff, I don't know if you know the story, but that's when I retired. And that's when I first got into real estate. And so at the time, I had a significant amount of savings that I was going to invest. So I started buying all these single family rental properties in Kansas City. So throughout 2012 and into 2013, I had amassed this very large portfolio of these single family rental properties that I paid for in cash. So here's this guy with these homes that he owns outright, and let's call it a 750 credit score. And I tried to go to the bank just to get like a 40% LTV line of credit, not a line of credit, Jeff, a line of credit.
They probably left out the door, right?
Yeah, they wouldn't give it to me. No. They said, absolutely not. And so that's right. The example I gave on the whiteboard videos, how money can be cheap because rates were at 0% back then, but money is by no means easy, except for the people, you know, the Black Rocks that are closest to the money, like Cantillon effect.
That's the thing, you know, it's cheap for who? And if it's not cheap for enough people, it's not actually cheap, right? And that's just, you know, during these deflationary periods, the reason why interest rates fall is because those are the interest rates we happen to measure. There's a lot of interest rates that we don't happen to measure. We don't know anything about, you know, mom and pop, like you, George, your mom and pop real estate business. You couldn't get a loan to save your life.
Right.
So your effective interest rate was infinity. But no, that doesn't show up anywhere, right? It doesn't show up in any calculation. So, you know, Google can issue all the corporate bonds it wants because it doesn't need the money anyway at an incredibly low interest rate that contributes to the idea that money is cheap, when in fact, in the real economy, more people are closer to infinity than Google.
Right.
Good. That's what people need to keep in mind, is it's what you can't see that often matters more than what you can, because we're told to look at these benchmark interest rates as if they're representative of the entire marketplace. But even in some of the risky stuff, like leverage loans that came to be really cheap, and junk bonds, those are not representative of the wider economy either. They're just representative of the cheap money that's available to certain kinds of borrowers, but not other kinds of borrowers. And when we see actually cheap money is when it's cheap for everybody or enough people that it contributes to the economic growth. But it's one of the biggest misconceptions and mistakes people make is that they look at, you know, the old Wall Street Journal page and think that this is representative of what's actually happening, when most of the time, especially in these deflationary periods, it's not. It's in fact, it's highly misleading.
Do you think we could get cheap and easy money if the Fed is taking everything onto their balance sheet? Like I think of PPP loans or something like that, you know, where that was cheap money for I don't want to say everybody, but we'll just say kind of more
criminals,
more of the masses. I mean, you know, thinking about what we were talking about before with the monetary and the fiscal policy in the next recession, or call it 2023, could we see something like that where the Fed is just guaranteeing any loan? And therefore the banks are just, why not create a loan? Why not create additional money? Why not make money cheap and loose if I don't have any downside risk because the Fed is backstopping it?
I think that's a common misconception too, is that banks didn't have any downside risk. You do have downside risk because you have to depend upon the federal government to bail you out when the loan goes bad, and the loan goes bad on your balance sheet. And so you got to report to shareholders, I got a bad loan. Yeah, I got a guarantee. But just because the federal government says I'm going to guarantee you a loan,
but do you think they can sell the paper? Do you think they can sell the paper like Fannie and Freddie? You know, they just sell the paper really fast. You think that in the next downturn, that's one of the quote unquote tools that they could use in addition to buying stocks, is where they just buy any paper that the banks want to sell them?
Yeah, but I think that's the difference. What I'm trying to say is that there's a difference between money creation and these one-time fits and starts, which is the hallmark of the Japanese way of doing things. Every time the Japanese would come in and do something big, it would look like it would work for maybe a year, 18 months, then it would all fall apart. Sound familiar? It's exactly what we've seen over the last 18 months. The government came in, did all this stuff, called it money printing. It wasn't really money printing. The economy seemed to respond, then it all falls apart again because it doesn't actually equate to money printing. It sure as hell is not a good enough substitute for legitimate economic growth, organic economic processes.
Right.
Because let's face it, the government is the worst institution at allocating capital or allocating anything.
Right.
You know, doing things bureaucratically is only going to be harmful in the long run.
Central planning. Call it central planning.
That's exactly what it is. And central planning can have short run effects and then it all falls apart. And usually when it falls apart, you're worse off than when you started.
Right.
And so money printing is very different than that. If banks were actually involved in this process and actually creating balance sheet space and capacity and doing it in a sustained fashion, then you would have inflation. But what the banking system said is outside of, in the United States at least, outside of their willingness to hold U.S. Treasury paper, there's no private credit creation whatsoever. And there was none in 2020 or 2021. In fact, that's one of the charts I showed at the Rebel Capitalist Live last month, was that look, when you take the federal government out of the total credit picture, it's as if 2020 and 2021 didn't happen. So the banking system is not creating the money, regardless of whether or not the Federal Reserve or the federal government was guaranteeing.
When you say it didn't happen, you're talking about the spike in M2.
Well, the M2 spike in M2 happened, but that was more of a reclassification thing.
Okay, so when you say it didn't happen, what is it? What are you referring to specifically?
Creating credit, creating loans, creating new securities. In fact, okay. You just see basically nothing happened. So banks were willing to buy U.S. treasuries, which made sense, safe liquid assets, a little bit of bump in return, a little bit of regulatory relief on that, on the onloading of the treasury securities. But by and large, private credit creation did not happen. It wasn't just in the U.S., but around the rest of the world. So the government came in and said, we're going to do a bunch of stuff. The banking system said, hey, you guys go ahead and do that. We're going to kind of sit on the sidelines and wait for it all to fall apart. And over the last couple of months, they've been buying treasuries again, because why wouldn't they? You're a global bank and you're seeing the stuff fall apart. You knew it was going to fall apart. You know how supply shocks end up. You see markets pricing deflationary risks. Of course, you're going to be buying treasuries, because what else are you going to be doing? Yeah. And I think that's the point, is it gets you back to your overall expectation. I call it that, George, is that 1940s, it looks a lot more instability in consumer prices as governments fumble around trying to find answers to a problem they can't even define. And again, the Japanese case shows that It doesn't, I mean, it has short run effects and then it all falls apart. And we just go through these upwards and downward cycles where it takes the government a lot of time to figure out it didn't work. We need to do another one. There's a recession in between. How bad does it get? You know, timing gets all screwed up and it's a period of high uncertainty because government is doing what it shouldn't be doing. The private market isn't doing what it should be doing, largely because the government's doing it and making things worse. And it just, it turns into an overall period of just crap, just awful economic conditions and financial conditions.
And lower standard of living. Yeah. Why?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the bottom line. Whether you have deflation or inflation, the net result is
doesn't matter. Pain.
And that's the,
exactly.
Less economic activity and the standard of living goes down.
Absolutely. It doesn't matter if it's inflation or deflation. You know, inflation is not the cure for deflation. And deflation is not the cure for inflation. Those right. are both things we should avoid. We should be in the middle. You don't want to be either of those things. And that's part of the problem with of modern economics and neo-Keynesianism is the idea that if you're in one, you need to use the other to get out of it.
Right.
That's just so stupid. That's not what you should be doing. Stability. There's a reason why human beings seek stability, because it leads to, hey, if the monetary system is stable, it's predictable, I can focus all my time and energy on productive processes. I don't need to pay some bank to manage my risks for me because I don't need to. Everything is very easy, predictable, and straightforward. So I can put all my energies into doing commercial enterprises that grow the economy.
Yeah. So there was a difference between what we have experienced pretty much globally in 2020 and 2021 and what Japan did, let's say, after the 1990 crash. So, you know, technically, okay, they're doing QE, they're doing all these things, but they weren't able to, I guess, create inflation, if you want to put it in those terms. But we did a fantastic job of that in 2020 and 21. So is it that we were just able to increase demand in the Japanese central bank and government was not? Or was it more so that there was just this global supply chain issue because they locked everyone in a cage and it was more of a supply? Well, I guess it would be both, right? Because we did better at increasing demand and we did better at, I guess, destroying supply.
Yeah, you want to put it. I think the Japanese example was their stimulus or their government intervention programs had less of an impact on demand for various idiosyncrasies about right. Japan, but they also did not have any of the supply shock characteristics that we have experienced too.
Yeah.
So in my mind, that is the primary difference of 2021 was the seriousness of the supply restrictions, which just contributed to that self-reinforcing spiral, especially you had the initial supply shock where prices went up, and then you had that secondary one after the Delta wave, and everybody overreacted to Delta. So you had a second supply shock that really hit around October and November. And that's kind of when the curve started saying, uh-oh, this is going to get bad, because the curves were looking at that second supply shock and thinking the effects of that second supply shock are probably going to be really bad. And so that when we do revert to the mean, we might revert to the mean much quicker. And then, of course, as economies and markets do, you undershoot as well as you overshoot. So I think that's the issue, is that what was different about 2021 was mostly on the supply side as much as anything else.
Do you think there's an argument for us having deflationary money but inflationary consumer prices because the supply chains get worse because of government intervention? Like China as an example, let's just say they're locking down, or we do that again in the United States. So they destroy supply chains even further than where they are today. Therefore, even if we do have deflationary money, it's not compensating for the inflationary pressures of having far less stuff.
I think if we're looking at China as a recent example, since Shanghai has been reopened and the East Coast cities and ports have been reopened, prices have been falling. So demand might be being destroyed faster than supply is being further restricted.
Right.
And I think that's really one of the worries when you look at commodity prices and some of the market curves, which are saying, yeah, China's, you know, they're restricting supply still, and then they might still pursue zero COVID, but demand might be falling off much quicker than supply is being restricted. And so you get deflationary pressures again, it's all about timing.
Yeah, right.
So it might be that we get into a deflationary period over the second half of this year. And then if supply is even worse next year, when we start getting into, hopefully, if there's not a prolonged recession, which is one of the worries we need to consider, but assuming there isn't one, we start to recover early next year, if supply is still restricted, we could go from rapid consumer price acceleration to rapid consumer price deceleration, if not deflation, to right back to rapid consumer price acceleration, which is your 1940s scenario, yeah, where you go from one to the extreme to the other, which is just, I think that's even worse. It's the last thing we want to see.
Yeah. All right, Jeff, let's talk about what you're doing with Steve and Tracy. It's a fun, exciting new project that you guys have.
Yeah, we're going to try to talk about all these things and try to educate as many people as we can. We have a research product that's available right now. It's for free. If you want to sign up at Markets Insider Pro, that's Markets with an S, insiderpro.com. You get, I get a couple pieces there, a daily research briefing, some deep dives. We go into euro dollar curves, markets, macroeconomic data. You've got Steve Van Meter's Momentum Timer Pro and Tracy Schuchart, who's just started to come up with a weekly research report of her own. I think for the next little while, those will be available. Again, free of charge, sign up.
And what does Tracy specialize in?
Oil and gas commodities, but really, I think her primary specialty is oil and gas market, which, I mean, let's face it, if there's not a bigger topic nowadays than oil and gas, then I don't know what it is, other than maybe deflationary money and collateral. So Tracy's got you covered. Steve's got you covered on trading some stuff. I've got the macro money picture, and all three of our reports are available.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and put a link in the description, and then the editors will put up the URL, because I know the first time I went there to sign up, which I have, so all you guys have to, I mean, it, I cannot wait to get this research. So you guys got to, as soon as this video's over, you got to check it out and give them your email address, and they'll give you this free information and intel. But I remember I typed in market without the S.
Yeah, that's somebody else,
And it wasn't even like a web page. So you got to put in the S.
Yeah, I got to have the S in there.
Yeah. But I'll have the editors put that up for sure. So yeah, Jeff, thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it. Usually when I email you to do an interview, it's because I have specific questions that I'm trying to think through. So this is, I know the audience loves it, but I must admit it's for selfish reasons. So thanks again, buddy.
That's great, George. Always happy to do it.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.